It's driving us crazy.
Good.
Wait for the gavel to hit so we have quorum. And
okay, if I could have your attention, we're going to call to order this February 2nd meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education. Everybody in the room, welcome to this committee. We hope to have a good session for you. We're going to have public hearings on a couple of our bills and possible work sessions. And we are going to start with House Bill 4061. House Bill 4061 is the bill that deals with university governance. And what, you know, as you members, as you know, when we had our information, our public hearing on this back in January, 2 weeks ago during legislative days, it seems like at least a month ago, presented to you the bill as introduced, and in that form, we left pretty much open the specific charge of the of the special committee that was going to be created. And the purpose of that was so that we could incorporate people's concerns through what they gave us in public testimony, through reactions from the members, through things that were to come to us in writing, and then incorporating elements of other bills that we knew were out there in the works. And pulling all those together, we came up with what became a -2 amendment. There was a -1, but that had an error, so forget about that one. It was -2, and we sent that out to the committee yesterday, I think, mm-hmm. both in prose form and in LC form for you. Then subsequent to that, we had further meetings with some of the legislators from Lane County who had a particular interest in this issue. Representative Johnson and I believe that we reached an agreement with them about what would be the proper way to handle this issue. And those principles are incorporated into the -4 amendments, which have been alive for about 45 minutes now. But they should be available to you all. And those are the ones that I want to explain. I think we have some public testimony that we'd like to hear. I see Senator Przanski, and I'd certainly be encouraged with look forward to hearing from you. So, the changes that are in the in the -4 amendment, they're very similar to what I sent to you yesterday, but there are some significant changes. First of all, with respect to one of the main charges of the, first of all, the term task force has been replaced with special committee. It was felt that the title Special Committee on University Governance was going to be the more appropriate term for the group that's going to be convened. And the makeup of that group is the same as it was in the measure as introduced. That is, there will be 4 members from the House, 4 members from the Senate, and 2 members appointed by the governor from the OEIB. Okay, so there would be 10 members in all. They will be called the Special Committee on University Governance. And one of their roles was to look at the coordination of the various elements. I actually don't have the base. Do I have the base bill before me?
Here it is.
Okay. Thanks. It says that the task force shall review, discuss, and analyze coordination among elements of the system with other education programs and missions. And we've inserted the word consolidation there. So it's coordination and consolidation. One of the things that was mentioned at the last hearing was that, you know, we now have, you know, we have the OEIB, we have the State Board of Higher Education, we have the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. In some cases, we will have local university boards. How many boards do we need, you know, is a question that a lot of people are asking. And so one of the things that the special committee will be looking at is ways of perhaps consolidating the number of boards. And I know that's a particular issue of Rep. Johnson. I don't know, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. As you well outlined, it's been a very dynamic and fluid process that brings us to here at this point in time today, and I think we've done our best to try to be adaptable and available for input and so forth, and I think we've got to that place where I think we've met most of the concerns that can reasonably be met at this point in time, and I think we've got a good document here that we'll talk more about in depth and hear testimony about. But in regards to consolidation, yeah, I think that's an important charge. You know, oftentimes, or what gets lost, I think, when people talk about the independent board issue that certainly is discussed in here is also the need for consolidation, at least to have a plan to make some recommendations about ways we can work more efficiently within the governance structures that we currently have and that we will have, recognizing that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission hasn't even been appointed yet. So we have governance aspects out there that aren't even in operation yet. So we've got enough of that there that we have to take a comprehensive view of what's necessary and what's needed if, in fact, we encounter a different environment and there is more independence available for some institutions. How does that impact the governance system that currently exists? So those are my feelings. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Great. Rep. Greenlick, did you want to say anything about that?
No, I just have some interest in consolidating certain.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Also, I certainly favor having consolidation as a piece of that.
Great. So,
Greenlick Amendment.
You know, in putting these amendments together, what we were struggling to do, frankly, was to bring together, you know, two major lines of interest. You know, one, you know, there are universities out there, we all know, who would like to have local boards. And we wanted to give them the certainty that, you know, if that's what they want, there is a path for them to get there. We want to make sure at the same time that all the wrinkles and issues, you know, whether it's around, you know, tuition or bonding or who owns the intellectual property, or there are just a lot of issues out there. And those need to be looked at very carefully, very deliberately, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we do something and then, you know, 2 days later realize we have to change it again. We want to go through the same kind of process that we used to very great effect in the process that led up to Senate Bill 242, where we had such a committee worked on this, and it took us to, you know, ultimately a very good place. It was a very transparent process. We had a number of public hearings. We got input. Different constituencies had concerns. They were all addressed. We ended up with something that, you know, ultimately, you know, against all odds, passed in the session because I think we had done such good work in advance setting it up. I know I was part of that process. Rep. Springer was. I think we may be the only two holdovers from that. And that's what we're hoping to replicate here. So what we have here in the amendments are a set of principles as well as a set of specific topics that need to be addressed. And, you know, I want to thank our friends at the University of Oregon Foundation who have worked with us to list the specific topics that they wanted to see considered by the special committee, as well as a timeline for dealing with these issues. The timeline is very aggressive, I will say. We are requiring this special committee to begin its work within 45 days of the end of session and to complete its initial recommendations by August 15th. And the goal of that is so that we can have something concrete that can then be reacted to prior to our committee days in September, when the you know, this committee and the Senate Ed Committee, perhaps meeting together, can take that report and begin the process of turning it into a bill for the 2013 session. So, you know, with that, I would be happy to answer any questions about any of that.
It says November 1st, not September.
I'm sorry.
It says the final report is November 1st.
The final report is, but the preliminary report is August 15th, which, you know, we expect to take out into the field, to take to the committees, and then have the final report in November. So with that, I would open it up to any questions or comments, committee members. Rep. Greenlick?
Mr. Chair, I have basically the same question I've had when we talked personally, and I will end up supporting this, but I wonder why we need a special committee rather than the existing policy committees on higher ed. And if we do this, does it mean we don't have anything left to do in the interim? It would make a quiet interim. I mean, it seems to me this is the reason we have policy committees.
Yeah, and if I could respond to that, Rep. Greenlick, this is frankly going to take a lot of work, and you know, I think it's going to take work, you know, beyond the normal purview of the standing committees, and I think that it's you know, we're going to have a number of meetings, you know, between now and August. And it just seemed impractical to leave it up to the regular framework of the standing committees. So that's why, and I can assure you, we're going to have plenty to do during the interim meetings, aside from this issue.
Rep. Hunt? Probably the one piece I struggle with, I think, as I'm reading through, I'm still absorbing the language, I think, but it talks about in the new subsection 3 that's outlined on the dash 4 amendments about the Legislative Assembly recognizing the potential benefit of individual public university boards. I'm fine with that. Talks about consulting with national experts to examine best practices and models of university governance. Fine. But then it does appear like it then goes and prejudges both the potential benefit and those consultations to say the special committee shall recommend legislation for the creation of local governing boards that then shall provide opportunity for local governments, etc. I guess I personally am not persuaded that there is definitively need for benefit from local governing boards. And I guess that language seems to be a little bit in conflict to me, where we're saying, here's a potential, go forth and pursue it, consult with national experts, but regardless of what you find, recommend XYZ. With some room to move within XYZ, it just seems a little prescriptive and a little prejudging to me of what that outcome is. And that's admittedly because I probably just have some doubts about that potential outcome. So I just wanted to flag that. It's not necessarily a question, just a slight reservation.
We're walking a very fine line here.
Could I add one other? I think the one other thing that I've found to be kind of a fascinating mix to me in this whole thing, and you get into a little bit when you're talking about the issues that they would recommend on. I'm glad to see that it specifically calls out issues around capital project, prioritization, authorization. It might be worth considering not just capital project prioritization and authorization, but funding, because it seems like in the whole discussion around local governing boards, there seems to be an inherent assumption that the benefits of local governing boards would be the ability to, you know, do all these things, hire and fire, maybe set tuition, maybe issue bonds, do a variety of things, but still the inherent assumption that the state is still going to provide continued capital funding for projects. So to some degree, a lot of the benefits, you kind of get the best of both worlds. You get the autonomy, and yet you also get the interdependence when the cash is done. It's like my son continuing to collect an allowance after he's moved out on his own. That's how it feels to me anyway. That's just as a parent still paying an allowance. So I don't know if there's another language that can be added there. I hope that's one of the things this group grapples with, is it doesn't seem like you can have, if there are local governing boards, I don't see how you can have both sides of that coin. It seems like if you make that choice, you've got to give up. If you're going to have the autonomy, you've got to give up some of the cash.
Thank you, Rep. Pond. You know, again, I think our assumption was that that would be an issue that would be on the table. That question of how capital projects will be authorized and prioritized. I will also point out we did in this draft, this Amendment 4, we have put in a role for the state treasurer's office because, you know, when we're talking about bonds and we're talking about capital projects, it's going to be important to have that professional, objective voice to be able to weigh in for us. Are there other questions or comments? Okay, why don't we hear from our people who've signed up to speak then, and in other words, continue this public hearing. So we'll start with, actually, Senator Przanski, would you like to start? Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be here today. State Senator Floyd Przanski, representing District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties, used to represent the University of Oregon in the Sinsipich facility up until January 1 of this year. And prior to that, I had the opportunity to represent them. I will tell you, first of all, in my caveats, I was asked to come to speak to this committee about 3 minutes before 3 o'clock. Apparently, Senator Beyer and Senator Edwards have maybe worn out their welcome. They feel like they have been around with the committee enough that they've heard from them enough, so they've asked for someone fresh to come. Please bear with me
nice
as I
fresh.
Bring the news that I am bringing. As one of the members of the Lane County delegation, I can tell you that we do support the concept of House Bill 4061 and what I understand of the Dash Ones. To Co-Chair Nimler, I understand that Dash Fours were available 45 minutes ago. I got word of them about 2 minutes after three. And so please bear with me with the terminology, and hopefully I will say to the terminology that's now in Dash Four. It's my understanding that what we are now asking is for the Special Committee on University Governance, Coordination, and Consolidation to be formed and established and move forward. We understand, as we all do, all of us have had the opportunity to serve in the legislature going through a session. I think a short session is kind of like exponentially making sausage. And so a lot of things are kind of viable and variable pieces that are moving through the system very quickly. It just happens that it's on the second day of our special session that we're already seeing it. Knowing where the governor has wanting to take us in some of the reforms that he has, knowing some of the issues that we have at a local level, we have in fact asked that these other conditions, terms, evaluations take place. And so that is why we as a delegation are asking for this committee to move forward the bill, understanding that the co-chairs have done a lot of work coming up with the Dash 4s, and we believe that this is the best we can move forward with, and it will in fact accomplish what is necessary, and that is to allow for the continued deliberation. And I use the word deliberation with sincerity, that this isn't something that we should just rush into. We do in fact need to have individuals that can commit the time that is necessary on a very short timeline to be able to turn out a product that we are all going to be proud of and not second-guessing through this process or once it's passed, if it does in fact make it to the floors of the two chambers in the 2013 session, which I hope it does. What I will tell you is that And my understanding of the Dash 4s is using a phase, and I apologize, I don't have the Dash 4s in front of me, so I can't give you the site on the page or line, but it is the rapid timeline for the local boards. And what I'm going to ask, thank you, is that that rapid timeline is a fluid term. It's one that I understand from hearing the discussion of what the co-chairs intend to be one that will be expedited, will move very quickly, and that we need to make certain that it does have the ability to have the flexibility to decide what is going to be recommended to us as a legislative body for the 2013 session. What I hope that will be also included is that predicting that it will move forward in a positive sense, that it will have a bill that will be before us in 2013, that bill will in fact allow for an emergency clause to be placed onto it. So for those universities who are ready to reach out and branch out and to go on an independent basis with a local board, that they would have the ability to do that and be ready to go forward for the 2013-2014 school year. So we can see this would be very exponentially, very fast. There are two comments that I would like to try to address, if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, from the Co-Vice Chair, Representative Greenlick, asking as to why the sitting committee should not be maybe the body that to do this. I can understand the desire to do that, but knowing how our meeting schedule is, I believe our next meeting is in May, with the follow-up being in September. And so unless the co-speakers are going to allow for additional meetings, I don't believe that the work could be done in such short meeting times. I also understand from the original bill, which I assume would still be included within the Dash 4s, it would not be just legislators that would be part of this mix. And I think that's very important, because one of the things that I heard Co-Chair Johnson wanting to have is this consolidation, and knowing that two of the members will be from another board, it's very important to have that input so we make certain we have a good product. And to Representative Hunt and his concerns as to whether we should continue to pay on allowance once they leave the nest, I would tell you that maybe we need to consider some type of road trips. And I'd say that in sincerity as to looking at what other states have done. Mm-hmm. I can tell you I'm a product from my birth state of Texas, going through the Texas A&M University system. And I would tell you that there is another system there known as the University of Texas system. Even though University of the Texas A&M system is now going into the SEC, I can tell you in my years when I was there, which was in the early mid-70s, I should say, that they actually did still have, let's say, that allowance portion, because for the state of Texas, they actually had oil and gas that they actually have endowments that actually go into both of those university systems. And I can tell you for the students that are here today, I wish we could offer them the same tuition rate I received, which, if I remember correctly, when I started in 1973, was $6 per credit hour. That's $6 per credit hour. Now,
I think it's different now, I think.
I think it is a lot more different now.
At least different.
So to me, it's one of those situations that we do want to move forward. I understand the hesitancy that we may have, but it seems like there will be enough checks and balances in the system for the special committee to consider and to move forward. And then we can actually, as a total body in the 2013 session, be able to decide on, yes, we're ready to go, or no, we're not. I personally hope we are. I do believe that there are universities within the system that can go forward. And if we had a lot more time, I would tell you, if I had my grand plan, how I would do it, but that's not before us today.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Anyone have any questions of the senator? Any comments about his tie? Yes, Rip Greenlick.
Certainly not a comment on his tie. I know better than that.
I can change it.
I think there's an independent bill going forward looking at making the University of Oregon an independent institution from the Eugene delegation, or at least pieces of that. How does it fit into that, the proposal? I think it's Representative Barnhart.
co-chairs and co-vice chair Greenlich. Well, I can tell you there are two bills that were being dropped by one by Representative Barnhart, the other one by Representative Beyer. I am not going to be able to be proficient to tell you the difference between those two bills and how they compare to this bill, but what I do know is sausage making. And what I do understand is that this is the bill that's going to be moving forward. We all, I think, recognize at this point this is going to give us the most comfort and the most, let's say, flexibility, latitude to take in all of the concerns. Clearly, there are many people who are part of the Oregon University system that feel that they want certainty, that some of the concerns that they have raised, which I support many of those concerns, are going to be addressed. And from hearing how Co-Chair Dimbrough has stated how the Dash Force have come forward, it seems like they were heard, and that's all I could ask. And so I thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative.
Senator Przanski, can you maybe speak to the issue of, and I realize you're maybe looking at the Dash Force for the first time, but where in that sub three there, it says that there's a recognition of the potential benefit of university boards and charges the subcommittee to do this consultation evaluation process. But then it says explicitly shall recommend legislation creating local governing boards. Obviously, you're starting with the position of there definitively should be local governing boards, and you said you even had some. I mean, if you had the ability to describe it, you could think of how it would be. Do you think it's critical to actually say to the group, don't just study the models out there and recommend the best outcome, but definitively recommend legislation for the creation of local governing boards? Because there seems to be a, here's the goal, go forth, but then prejudging the place they land.
Yeah. I will, Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Hunt, I guess first I'm going to defer as to not knowing and not seeing dashboards until, as I said, coming into this room and being told that they had been, let's say, fresh off the press and for consumption. I believe what I would tell you is in this process, there's been some compromises that have been made. And one of the things is being able to count to 31 or to count to 16. And from the Lane County delegation's perspective, we want some assurances that we are going to have this go forward to the point of where it can be considered. Now, clearly, we as a legislature in 2013 will have the final say. And if we determine at that point sure, we're not ready or we don't want this, it's not going to go forward. But I do believe that one of the assurances that was asked for was that they would be on the table for discussion in 2013. And I believe this is the way that this has been structured to make certain it is going to be part of the discussion in 2013 and that it would be considered or would be able to be considered in 2013 exponentially fast in the beginning. So by having it in the original bill, I believe that is the predicate for allowing that to occur. Right. Now, that does not mean that, from my perspective, that this special committee couldn't come back with some other recommendations and actually state their positions as to whether the desire that's set forth in Dash Force is the best model or not. Now, there, as I mentioned, and I didn't maybe clarify quite well enough, but from what I remember from my days in Texas, both of those systems have Board of Regents. And so both those schools are actually operated underneath those Board of Regents, but still the legislature has a lot of say over those schools. And what I have seen from since going through the university, there's been consolidation in the university campuses. Some that were smaller individual campuses are now part of one of those two systems. And they have found that to be what works for them. Now, that doesn't mean that's what would be best for us, But I think that you can just look to the neighbors to the north and the neighbors to the south and know and see from what their systems are set up and seeing that they're, they seem to be viable, they seem to be working, and there are much more independents than what we currently have in the state of Oregon.
Yes, thank you for that, Senator. You know, I think, you know, if you look at our goals with these amendments, they reflect a vision for the of the work of this special committee, that it will be, you know, A, fact-driven, and B, principle-driven. And, you know, the notion of it, you know, talking about the potential benefit of individual boards, there is a potential benefit if we get all the pieces right. If we get all the pieces right and we follow those other principles that we've laid out, you know, principles including, you know, we say define how local boards will be appointed, ensuring that students, faculty, and other university staff will be represented. Ensure that the creation of a local board is the result of a careful analysis of the costs and benefits of such action. That it, you know, ensure that it will mitigate potential adverse impacts upon other universities. You know, as long as we follow these principles, then and can come up with a system that incorporates those, then I think we will see a potential. We will see the benefit, not just potential, but the true benefit of the university boards. If we don't come up with something that reflects those principles, then you know, I think I would say then. It's going to be hard to see the benefit of the university boards. So,
just a Mr. Chair, a quick comment about that. You know, I think there's a difference between a piece of legislation that mandates that an institution shall adopt an institutional board and legislation that creates a clear pathway so that those institutions that desire to pursue that pathway can do so with some clearly defined criteria about what they need to do in order to be able to continue down that pathway. So I think that's what, that's the intent of this legislation, is to create a clear pathway, and that's what the committee's being charged with, that we then as legislators will have an opportunity to look at when we get back here in 13 and say, is this what we think is appropriate based on what criteria and so forth and so on. So I appreciate your comments, Senator. I think you've
encapsulated,
I think, what we're trying to do here and not prejudge the work of the committee, but say we would like some tangible work in this area, so that we can come back with something significant and concrete that we can consider in 2013.
All right, and I think to the full committee co-chairs, I think it is important, extremely important. I've always tried to practice is trying to be much more inclusive, and I think by having the requirement and the actually spelling out that these various groups, special or say interested parties within the university system are actually represented or at the table is essential.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Okay, we have two students next, Tiffany Dollar and Chris Heidbrink. Chris Heidbrink? Heidbrink, sorry. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. This testimony is not going to be as pleasant as my last one was, so I'm going to just yank it off like a old Band-Aid for you all today. Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Dembro, thank you for allowing me the time to speak again today. We really do appreciate the time that you spend listening to students in this committee. It's important to us. As mentioned previously,
Tiffany, could you identify yourself?
Huh?
Identify yourself.
Yes,
please.
I am Tiffany Dollar.
Thanks.
And I'm the board chair of the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students across the state of Oregon from public community colleges and universities across the state. I am here to comment on House Bill 4061, the Higher Education Task Force bill. First, I want to thank Representative Hunt for his questions, which really mirror the concerns of students at this time, and those are students across the state. during the January legislative working days, both Ben Eckstein and I, representing the Oregon Student Association, testified in support of legislative concept 288. That LCE was intended to research how we might streamline the existing governance structures, including the HEC and the OEIB, as well as research the possibility of local boards. These new amendments change this task force into a special committee and implement local boards. We are extremely disappointed in these changes. The intent, purpose, and charge of this task force would be eliminated with these amendments. Our organization voted to support the legislative task force because it focused on finding real solutions, searching for in-depth and diverse opinions and research, and taking the time necessary to consider major changes. The amendments proposed today remove this thoughtful approach. The Oregon Legislature needs to first take time to research what can be achieved through the new performance compacts and coordinating boards. We need to spend the next year addressing possible duplication and researching the possible benefits of local boards. States like Florida made too many changes to their higher education governance too quickly, and now competing bodies of post-secondary education governance are suing each other for authority. Why would we rush changes like Florida and risk the time and resources it may take to reverse these decisions? As students, we are most interested in what forms of governance keep tuition prices affordable. Clearly, our tuition is not $6 a credit, several hundred dollars a credit, at Portland State at least. We want to know what governance forms experts think are best for Oregon. We want to know what governance structures keep Oregonians in mind and in the admission process. We want quality education, and we want increased graduation rates of all students. We want institutions that recruit and retain students from underrepresented communities. We want to know what governance structure limits negative competition between schools. We want, as the governor's office says, form to follow function. These amendments are backwards. Students are paying more than 50% of what it costs to run a public university, and we want a task force that will hear from stakeholders and take time to look at all governance options for Oregon's post-secondary education system. You would not see me in a research methodology class creating a conclusion before I had done any research. That is exactly what this bill does. These amendments draw conclusions before we examine the evidence and debate the proposals. We need more time to look at these amendments, and it sounds like some of the folks in the room may feel the same way. At this time, we oppose all of the amendments and request that you do not vote on this today. Do not direct the state's time and money toward developing legislation before stakeholders and experts can be heard. Don't create a conclusion before you do the research. Please do not adopt these amendments, and let's stay focused on researching and planning for what's best for all Oregonians and for post-secondary education. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Why don't we hear from Chris, sorry, first.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Danbrough, Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the committee. My name is Christopher Heidbrink. I am the student body president at Eastern Oregon University. I'm also a board member for the Oregon Student Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. I'd like to echo the concerns that Tiffany has mentioned about the proposed amendments to House Bill 4061 and explain why students from regional universities are concerned with these proposed amendments. First, what research led the committee to so drastically alter its direction from discussing the various options in university governance, including the local boards, to deciding they were already best for Oregon? If these amendments are adopted, I don't see the research opportunity or the research or the opportunity for stakeholders to weigh in that the original legislative concept would have afforded. We need to put the function before the form, as the governor's office says. We need to address how the OEIB and the HEC and other governance structures will reduce and control the competition between our institutions. What if competition in this building for bonds and funding wasn't controlled or at least monitored by a solid statewide system of universities? What would happen to our regional campuses? These questions have not been fully vetted, and that is why we supported Legislative Concept 288. Local boards are not and should not be a foregone conclusion. The Oregon Student Association has been opposed to all individual campus proposals for local boards to this point. Our position matters, as our stakeholders cover more than 50% of the costs to run our campuses. Furthermore, we have questions regarding the tuition setting authority. We want to know about the articulation agreements. We want to know when the authority of the HEC and the OEIB will be clarified. And we want to see all of these new additions get worked out before we add new governance structure that might harm our regional campuses. There are a lot of questions that need to be answered still. We ask that you do not accept these amendments and draw the conclusion before you form the hypothesis or do the research. At the very least, at this time, we ask that while we are opposed to these amendments, you give us a couple days to become better acquainted with them so that we can form a more solid opinion with these most recent amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Comments or questions? You know, let me just say that, you know, our hope is to approve these amendments today, but we won't be moving the bill to the floor until next week, just to respond to your last point. You know, both of you raise, you know, real concerns, serious issues, and, you know, I know that based on the performance of OSA and the student participation in the last work group, the one that led to Senate Bill 242, I know that you're going to stay very engaged in this process. And I know that you will be analyzing it every step of the way. And if it looks as if, the proposals that are coming out of the task force are going to not be in, you know, the interests of students and not meeting that fundamental principle that we have, which is, it's here somewhere.
I'm sorry.
No, no. To ensure that the public mission of Oregon's public universities, including access and affordability for residents of this state, is maintained and enhanced. That if the solutions that the work group that the special committee is moving towards don't meet that very high standard, you're going to let us know, and I know I for one am not going to support anything that doesn't meet that goal. We're walking through, a narrow path with cliffs on either side, but I think this is a path forward that will take us to a better place. Thank you. Yes,
just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thanks. Just to respond again to some of your concerns and their valid concerns, I think we all share them about tuition, affordability, articulation, all these issues. But I think the other thing to keep in mind is there's so many moving pieces within all of public ed right now in Oregon, and some of them are yet to be determined. But specifically in regards to say achievement compacts, I certainly hope that the achievement compact legislation call specifically for achievement compacts with each institution, where each institution will be held accountable for exactly what you're talking about there, that they will be held accountable at the OEIB for performance in many areas. But so in addition to the criteria that I think the legislation or the proposed legislation comes back to us to consider in 13 is one thing in regards to the adoption of the local boards or if in fact institutions want to have it or not. But I think on a separate path, you're going to have an achievement compact with a different governing entity that's going to ensure that they will be addressing many of the concerns you talk about right now, because they're valid concerns, and I think we all share them. So just thought I'd throw that out there, too.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, finally, I call up Paul Weinhold. Thank you. Mr. Weinhold, pleasure to see you again.
Good to see you as well. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Denbrough, and members of the committee, thank you again for giving me the opportunity to present to you. For the record, I'm Paul Weinhold, President and CEO of the U of O Foundation. Thank you for your work on this issue and your efforts with the legislation and your ongoing attention to improving higher education in Oregon. 2 weeks ago, I addressed you about the importance of using the first annual session to continue the work that we began, that was begun last year with the passage of Senate Bill 242 and 909. This was all good work, and we all agree that it was a beginning, not an end, to overdue higher education reform in the state. You're well aware the U of O and its community of alumni who are strongly in support of creation of a publicly appointed independent boards. Our rationale is simple. If we want to achieve ambitious outcomes in higher education, we need an equally ambitious effort to modernize higher education governance. The current system is outdated and needs modernizing. It was established in the 30s when college education was a luxury and the state provided nearly all of the funding for each school. Today, a college education is no longer a luxury. It's essential, and the state provides less than 7% of the funding. While nearly everything has changed in higher education over the past 80 years, our system of leadership, governance, and decision-making remains the same. Senate Bill 909 and 242 recognize the need for change. The next step is creating publicly appointed, publicly accountable, university-specific boards. And I urge you to take the strongest possible action this session to establish an irreversible path to modern university governance, a path with a time-certain destination for the establishment of local governing boards for universities that want them, governing boards that have real responsibilities and that remain accountable to a single statewide education authority, as is envisioned in the Oregon Education Investment Board, and as important, accountable to the legislature and the citizens of Oregon. What we seek is an independent board, not independence from Oregon's family of universities, community colleges, and local school districts. Far from it. Consistent with the vision of the OEIB, the goal of greater autonomy must be to ensure that the U of O or any other institution with its own board is even a stronger participant and partner in helping Oregon achieve our shared education and economic ambitions from early childhood to college. We recognize that with greater autonomy also comes greater responsibility. We welcome it, and we are confident that by accepting more responsibility locally, we will lead to not only to better university governance, but a better university and a better university system. What we would like to see in this legislative session approval of institutional boards this year and in this session. We know that's not going to happen. But there are plenty in the U of O community, dedicated, passionate advocates for the institution that would love to see it and frankly wonder why it didn't happen last year. With this in mind, and with the recognition that this is not going to happen this year, but with this in mind, we've committed ourselves over the past few weeks to working with you, the legislative leadership, and the governor to create a clear and certain path for approval of university-specific boards next year. While a great deal of progress has been made, we believe that the legislation as initially introduced before this committee falls short, and we encourage you to adopt amendments put forth by Representative Val Hoyle and Senator Prezansky to ensure greater certainty for the implementation of university-specific governing boards next year. We are eager to work with you and your partners to improve this legislation. While it was introduced, it is certainly better than the status quo, but we could not endorse the legislation as it was initially introduced. I also want to leave you with one final thought about the urgency of creating a strong and hopefully stronger path to certain university-specific governance at the University of Oregon. Right now, we are in the process to try to recruit a world-class president to the University of Oregon, someone with experience and vision. We believe strongly, as does our interim president, Robert Berdahl, that uncertainty in governance will create uncertainty in our candidate search and make the task of recruiting the best possible leader very difficult. On the other hand, greater certainty in governance will open new doors for opportunity in recruiting a new and dynamic university president, a president ready and eager to accept both the responsibility and accountability that comes with greater autonomy. Members of the committee, again, thank you for your leadership and your attention to higher education, and we look forward to working with you in the days and months to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weinhold. Any questions for the witness?
Thank you very much.
Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4061, and I will open a work session on House Bill 4061. Rep. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 4061.
Any discussion of the motion?
I would just say I actually think there's a lot of good stuff in here, including some of the stuff that you quoted after the students spoke. I mean, I think it actually, there are several pieces that strengthen the original draft. I just think, unfortunately, it's got a tragic flaw of prejudging. Even as it helps focus, I think it then too narrowly focuses. So I will be opposing this amendment.
Any other discussion? Yes, Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say that I appreciate all the work that's gone into this, the conversations that I was not privy to, not able to participate in, but I appreciate the point that's been reached and the amount of work that's gone into it. Thanks. I'll be supporting.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, Mike, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Nope.
Representative Lindsay?
Excused.
Representative Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Greenlee?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Yes.
Co-Chair Dembro?
Aye. Okay, the Dash 4 amendments are adopted. And with that, I will close this public hearing on House Bill 4061. And we will move on now to the subject of textbooks. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4058. Great. So just by way of introduction to this bill, House Bill 4058 is the Affordable Textbook Act, which those of you who were with us last session did experience in some form or the other. It was a bill that passed unanimously out of the Higher Ed Subcommittee of the Education Committee last time, and it then was transformed into another bill, which was widely supported by the Higher Ed Committee and the Education Committee, but for reasons of timing at the end did not move forward. And so Rep. Johnson and I decided to propose it to the committee as a committee bill, and it was agreed to submit it as a committee bill. It's a bill that, as introduced, has required some changes, which I'll talk about. But before we do that, I'd like to have the public testimony about the need for doing something about the affordability, or rather the lack of affordability, of textbooks for students in this state and elsewhere. So with that, I will call back once again my friend Tiffany Dollar and Devin Bormore. And what do we do two at a time? So.
Again, good afternoon, Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Tiffany Dollar, and as mentioned before, I'm the board chair of the Oregon Student Association. At our last board meeting, we took a vote unanimously to support House Bill 4058. We need to find a way to lower the cost of education. This bill is a good start. Textbooks are an unbounded contributor to the constant rise in the price of post-secondary education. We talk a lot about tuition and financial aid, but if you can't afford your books, there's no real chance of succeeding in your classes. As a student at Clackamas Community College and now Portland State University, I spend hundreds of dollars a term on textbooks. I have a full load and I work almost full time. At the risk of sounding dramatic, you should know that when I go to buy a book, I have to think seriously about how that will affect my grocery money for the month. Students are constantly making choices between books and other day-to-day necessities. Last term, one of my colleagues at Lane Community College spent over $735 on science textbooks. I ask members of the committee, when in the last century has lower division chemistry changed? This bill asks that the boards of education and the Oregon University system look into ways to reduce the cost of textbooks. And as students, we know that there are a number of ways to do that. Some student governments use fees to increase their library's textbook banks. This is a really great option for students. They can go into the library, they can use the textbook in the library for a specific amount of hours, but they can't take it home, so it's really tough for students who maybe are non-traditional, work full-time and have children. It's not as convenient for them, and often those students are the ones who have the most economic hardship of any students. Some student groups help their peers buy and sell books to one another, but that only works if professors commit to using older versions of the textbook. Students have worked with bookstores to keep publishers from bundling books together, so you only have to purchase what you need. Students appreciate when professors assign homework problems in the syllabus from the old and the new textbook versions. And students across the state have worked with professors to see online textbooks as a real solution for their problems in the classroom. When I was a student at Portland Community College, we were able to give a grant to a physics instructor and buy a classroom set of physics books at a very low cost to the student government and supply that for the lower division physics class. So there are options out there, and we want to let you all know that we really support the idea of those being investigated further. Students have tried to tackle this issue, and now we would like the state to commit to lowering the cost of textbooks. Even with all these cost savings, students are still paying an average of $900 a year on their textbooks. On another note, this was the first year that university rolled fees into the cost of tuition so that financial aid could cover both tuition and fees. But the cost of textbooks, although crucial to succeeding in the classroom, was not included in the new figure. This is because the cost of textbooks is different for every student. We need to find a way to better anticipate the cost of success so students can take loans and seek the financial aid they truly need. Please seriously consider the importance of this bill and vote yes on House Bill 4058. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany. Yes.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Dimbrough and Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Devin Bearmore. I'm part of Eastern Oregon University's student government and a board member for the Oregon Student Association. My peers and I have traveled from LeGrand today to speak to you about textbook affordability and with our elected officials, Regional campuses are a point of access in the state. Students at EAU are very price sensitive, and we know that disproportionate costs our education is ever-growing costs of textbooks. Last term, I spent $462 on textbooks. That is the equivalent of 20% of my tuition for one term at EAU. Furthermore, regional campuses are at a risk of not having the 3.5% holdback returned, which at EAU might mean to max out our tuition increases again this year. It also possible EAU will go above the budget note you all set to create tuition ceilings at our school. With the grave reality of increasing costs in education, we need to put together this task force to address at least one aspect of the constantly rising costs. We can We can be doing more, but with ever-dwindling state support of regional campuses, we can't simply purchase textbooks for our library. We need creative solutions. We need collaboration and bulk purchasing with other institutions. This task force will address creative solutions to our rising costs. We also appreciate the seat for bookstore owners and other stakeholders. Lasting solutions have to include all stakeholders. Please seriously consider the importance of this bill and vote yes on House Bill 4058.
Thank you very much, Devin. Any questions?
Can I just comment?
Yes, yeah, please, your comments. I'm sorry.
I mean, I think this is as critical an issue as we're going to face, frankly. And I taught many years at Portland State and taught sociology for a long time, and I was just appalled by the price of sociology textbooks. But instructors used to get free textbooks, so I gathered all my free textbooks together, put it up in the office, and said, students, come and pick any one you want, because it doesn't matter. Today I'm going to do the section on socialization, so figure out where it is in the textbook you pick. And because it really didn't matter. It's the same as chemistry. I mean, there hasn't been a new introductory sociology textbook in 100 years either. But, you know, I watched my grandkids in college also. I've had a fresh view of it. And it's appalling, and it's particularly appalling because we have a technology that means that doesn't happen now. I've been working with a book I want to put on the market, and you can now get a 6x9 book produced for less than $10 a piece, print on demand. So I mean, they can be purchased one at a time for, say, $17 or $18 or $20, make a good profit, do it one at a time. And this notion of charging $100 or $200 or $300 for a textbook, it's just appalling. And if we can do, we can figure out some way to do something about it, Mr. Chair, let's do it, because I really feel for what they face in their budget every semester.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, too. I'll call up Riley Griffith and Zach Steele.
The professors that create a co-op to produce books.
That's how it should be.
This is outrageous.
Let's help it happen.
Let's hope that happens. I need to figure out how to make it happen. Switching. Something about this problem.
Okay, you guys decide who wants to go first.
All right, I'll go. That's
pretty good.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Dembro. And good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson. And also, good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. Came quite far, and I am very much enjoying it. My name is Riley Griffin, and I am a member of the Eastern Oregon University student government. I came here today to speak with my elected officials about the importance of Eastern Oregon University and talk to you about the ever-rising cost of textbooks. Eastern Oregon plays a very important role in the state. We educate a key region and allow students from family farms and family businesses to stay in that vital region. As Devin said, Eastern Oregon students are very price sensitive. And we know that a disproportionate cost of education is coming from the ever-growing cost of textbooks. Last term, I spent $200 on textbooks and course materials, which is equivalent, roughly the equivalent of 10% of my actual tuition. With the risk of deeper budget cuts and an increased tuition, I urge our state to address the rising cost of textbooks. We at OSA appreciate the work of members like yourselves who helped us to pass Senate Bill 365 in 2007. Senate Bill 365 banned companies from bundling textbooks together. Unfortunately, this bill is not well enforced and more could be done. House Bill 4058 is one example of a solution to lower the cost of textbooks. I hope that you all see the value in this task force and vote yes on House Bill 4058. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Zach?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Dembro and Co-Chair Johnson and other members of the committee. My name is Zachary Steele. I'm a senior at Eastern Oregon University, majoring in politics, philosophy, and economics. and also an active student leader. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4058. The stereotype is that only math and science majors pay an excessive amount on textbooks. From my experience, I'm here to tell you otherwise. Last term, I took 15 credit hours and spent well over $570 on textbooks alone. I took constitutional law, which required two textbooks, totaling $370 for that class. Much like chemistry, constitutional law has not changed much in the last 20 years. With websites such as OES, Justia, Fine Law, and many other Supreme Court websites, why do professors need to require a textbook when you can get documentaries from Harvard Law Journals and other things free from our campuses? The other book class I took that required a textbook, which was only one credit and meant for only 3 weeks, was statistics, paid $100 for a used textbook for 3 weeks. The final course I took that required a textbook was U.S. Economic History. Again, hasn't changed much in the last few years. A used textbook cost only $80. However, this total cost of books cost me the equivalent to 24% of my tuition for one term. Even though I'm in the National Guard and Army ROTC and they both provide me economic assistance for school, I still have incurred a substantial debt. I still pay outrageous prices for textbooks out of my own pocket. While the average student pays only $900 on books, I've spent well over $1,200 in my short 3 years at Eastern Oregon University. I urge you, the representatives who sit on this committee, to pass House Bill 4058. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Riley. Zach, sorry. And Riley, you know, you mentioned the 2007 bill about the unbundling, and you know, your sense that perhaps that has been applied kind of erratically over the years. And you know, one of the things that we put specifically into this bill is the work group that comes together to look at potential options. One of the things that we're also asking them to do is look at, so how well are we doing with that bill? That bill was then seized and taken over at the national level, and we have federal law around this as well. But you know, I suspect that, as you say, it's being implemented very erratically, and it would be good to get a sense of that.
Mr. Chair, if I...
Yes, Representative.
Yes, I remember correctly from working on that bill. There's also a section or a companion bill that required textbook salespeople to inform the faculty of the price of the textbooks. I'd like to hear from some faculty to see if that ever happened as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, we have a faculty member up next, and... I want to thank all the students for not laying the blame for this on the faculty, that hardworking, righteous group of citizens.
Wait a minute.
But, okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So I'll call up Dr. Mark Perlman.
Mr. Chair, should you declare a conflict of interest before?
It's a potential conflict, yes.
Sorry, it's going to take me a while because I brought visual aids.
Oh, nice.
You must teach math or science.
No. I took a little tour of the bookstore today in preparing, doing research.
Oh, sweet.
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a professor of philosophy at Western Oregon University. I'm also a member and the former president of the Western Oregon University Federation of Teachers, the local of American Federation of Teachers in Oregon. And... I'm in favor of this bill, and I'm acutely aware of the problem that our students have in affording textbooks. And we know the tuition's going up. We know that the state appropriations for higher ed is going down, so there's already a burden on students to be able to afford education. And a lot of them really don't think about textbooks as being as significant of an economic issue as tuition, when it is. And I've talked to students in my classes, you know, some of them are your traditional students. They're going to school full time. They're not working at the time. But we have a lot of students who are not on that simple of a path. Students working two or three jobs, student with a job and kids at home and a full load of classes at school. And, you know, they have to make compromises in all sorts of ways. I was talking to a student who's only taking 12 credit hours, which is just barely full-time. She would want to take more, but she doesn't have enough money this term to take as many as she would like. And I did a little tour of the bookstore today, and I have some of my own, but I found the champion, the prize winner of the bookstore. So these are mine from my intro to philosophy class. This one, just for example, this little skinny book is $44. But it's packed full of philosophy.
That book can be produced for $8.
Well, right.
No, literally.
This one is the companion one, and it's it's 400 pages, but it's $56. Still doesn't. I got this one because the one I used to use cost too much. The one I used to use was over $100, so I downsized and got this one, which is half the price of the other one. Now, this one, I teach philosophy of law, which, you know, law books are expensive. This is the cheapest one I could find. The one I used to use cost twice as much. This one, paperback, is $123 in the bookstore. And half of it's written in the United States Supreme Court, which is not copyrighted. So I don't know where the 120. But these are the two that I'm really interested in. You were just talking about bundling. It's bundled. You can't get it non-bundled. And there's a little, this is an education book teaching students. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of a workbook, but there's also this cardboard thing in here, which is the access code to get to the online materials. And that makes this a complicated book because the book, I guess the whole package requires to use the online materials. The online code expires at the end of each term. And you can't buy the book without the online code. And so you can't sell the book back because it's useless now that the online code that is bundled with it expires. You can also buy, for some books, you can buy just the online code. Here. So instead of buying the $150 book, you can spend $100 just to buy, you know, that code number and have access online. But this is the champion of the day, biochemistry. I'd be happy to get rid of this tomorrow when I take it back. But $253 for one book for one term. This one's used, but new, it's 253. Used, it's a mere 180. But that's crazy. I mean, if you're working minimum wage, which many of our students are, how long? You have to work about 3 or 4 weeks to buy this book. And I don't know if that doesn't conclude using any of your salary to eat, because I don't think the book pages are very good. And that's just one class, one book. I mean, maybe with a little barbecue sauce. If you look at students who are typically taking 4 classes, 5 or 6 classes a term, on the cheap side, if they only spend about $100, then that's $400 to $600 a term. So that's more like $1,200 to $1,800 a year, just for books. And if they're taking biochemistry, then I figured out the math, somewhere between $3,600 and $5,000 a year for books. Now, I've had cars that were a lot cheaper than that. But we've got to do something. And one thing that I learned about from the woman that works at the bookstore at Western is we have a program that's for textbook rental. And we got a grant to do it because otherwise we couldn't do it. And the grant basically bought sets of these books. And the books are things like this. So instead of buying the book, you rent it for a term. And that's about $50. To rent the book and then give it back at the end of the term. And to make that work out, she said they need to use the same one for 9 terms kind of continuously so that by the 9 terms, 9 times 50, something about her math doesn't add up.
Yeah.
maybe it was a $300
book. She has to take her percentage.
Well, I mean, the bookstore, they have to turn the lights on. They have to pay rent for the space. So, you know, they add a premium to all the publisher's prices of the books. But the rental program, I know that's something that's in your bill, and we've got this relatively small-scale version of that as an experiment that we were fortunate to get a grant for. I think it was a 3-year grant, and we have a half a year left on the grant, so then we'll be back to trying to figure out something. You know, I've also got students that buy books not from our bookstore. They, you know, surf the web and find the cheapest copy they can find. And that's, I mean, I would do that if I was buying textbooks. The only downside is sometimes they buy them online the first day of class, and then they have to wait for them to be delivered. So it's week three, and they say, well, I'm still waiting for my book. You know, I saved a lot of money, but they couldn't use it to study for the first 3 weeks of the class. The rental seems like a good idea, except you can't write in them because obviously you would kind of use them up. And I was always the one that wanted to scribble things in the margins. And so then there are options of online materials and just don't have paper at all. You can't write on this. We shouldn't write on the screen either. Uh-huh. So there are difficulties, and I'm glad to see that you're looking to try and find a way to make progress on this. My number one pet peeve is that all these publishers come out with new editions about every 2 years, and the old editions would have been fine. And I tell the bookstore, if we could use the old edition again, use it. And they say, well, we can't find enough copies, or we can't be sure we can find enough copies. And so the publishers know full well that they're losing money because there are used books, and they're specifically working to make sure that they make as much money as they can by having new editions coming out. And like some of the other people said, you know, I teach ancient philosophy. Not a lot has changed about Plato and Aristotle since the last edition, but they have to buy new copies because of that. And, you know, I'm not sure what the ultimate answer is, but we need to do something because people are getting priced out of being able to afford an education at just the point where the tuition is already the most it's ever been for them to be getting an education. And then this, it's making it almost impossible. So I'm happy to see that you're working on this. And I think I can speak for most, if not all, of my faculty colleagues by saying we'd be in favor of you're making progress on this because our students need it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Any questions for Dr. Perlman or comments? Rep. Greenlich?
Is your impression that your colleagues are pretty aware well of what the price is, pretty well aware of what the price is for the textbooks they order?
I would say probably not. Yeah. I mean, even if you know what the price is that the publisher has listed somewhere, I mean, maybe they put it somewhere, but they don't. It's not like they make it obvious. If you really want to find it, you can probably find it. But then you have to consider, well, what's the bookstore actually selling it for? Because the bookstore has to pay employees and the electric bill and the rent. So the cost of the book may not be the price that the students pay in the bookstore because of overhead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Rep. Greenlich. Yeah. And I have a comment about that as well.
The book in your class of constitutional law, could you not use a textbook? I mean, I finally gave up using textbooks in anything beyond 101.
I think I could. And theoretically, the court things are available. One of the problems I've had, I mean, and I have colleagues that, you know, we worried about paper for the Xerox machine. And, you know, if I hand out a handout to my class, then it's going to cost money out of our budget. And so they want to put everything online. And unfortunately, shoving a piece of paper in their hands is the number one best way to get them to look at it. And, you know, having them have the book, I think they're more likely to read it than sending them to a website and say, you know, this one's on this website, this one's on that website, this one's on the other website, this one I can't have you read because it's copyright.
We went through copyright stuff and created a package and sold the package to the students to cover the budget.
Yeah, I mean, there are companies mm-hmm. that are now doing that. Of course, the downside for that is that you can't resell them. Or unless I promise the bookstore that for the next 5 years I'll be using that packet, they won't buy it back. And even then, they probably won't buy it back. And so I have used Xerox packs in the past, but they bring their own problems. And so mm-hmm. you know, I feel bad making them buy a $123 book, but it's cheaper than the other alternatives as far as owning a book. And I don't really know what the ideal solution would be, but mm-hmm. you know, I think percentage-wise of what I spent when I was going to school, books were not anything like the percentage of total expenditure that they are now.
Right.
No, that's certainly true, Mark. And as astronomically as tuition has grown over the last couple of decades, the cost of textbooks has gone even higher, I think, in my experience. And to Rep. Greenlick's question about how easy it is to find out the price, it is possible to find out the price. Prior to the law, it was literally not possible to find out the price until it came to this school. Now you can, you know, with after multiple clicks on web pages, get to the price. But the advertised material will not include a price. It will not include a price on the cover page. You know, when we're sent material from the publishers advertising a new book, the price won't be there. You can find it, but you have to search for it. I will say that there are some programs now that are out there, applications like for the cell phone and for the computer, where you can type it in and. Or say, you know, you're looking for philosophy, and they'll give you the whole range of books at that price. And that's a useful service, although some people are charging for that service now as well. Everything is monetized. I think the central purpose behind this bill, or the central philosophy, is there is no one silver bullet to this, I mean, to echo your point. For some people, in some courses, completely online material is going to work. For some students, they just can't function in a completely online environment. They need paper. So, therefore, I always, when I have online material for my students, I want it to be in a form where it can be downloaded. You know, they can print it off on their printers and at least have a paper copy. I think that it's going to take a combination of rental, of bulk purchasing licenses, but also I think a key part is going to be open source textbooks. I think where there's just a different model for how faculty, I heard over there something about faculty co-ops, but where faculty are coming together and perhaps with some subsidy creating textbooks that can then be made available to everyone in the state at little or no cost. You know, I think those are things we really need to look at, and that's the purpose of this, to convene a group to share those ideas and then to get them out statewide and do the statewide coordination.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Our final two people are Andrea Henderson and Cam Preuss. You're not on the list, but I'm calling you up. So. Yeah, I'm sorry. Karen is going to substitute for Andrea. And I appreciate your being in the room. Let me just take a moment to say that what we have currently are the Dash 1 amendments to this bill, and the Dash 1 amendments are an attempt to make this process happen at little cost to the state. People on the dais will be familiar with this philosophy. For any of the work like this that we need done this session, we have to make it either no cost or very little cost. We probably are not entirely there yet, so we're not going to be adopting these amendments today. I think we're going to have to go for a Dash 2 to make one more little tweak to make it so that we can really bring the cost down to nothing. But the goal here is going to be that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, which comes into creation this July 1st, is going to convene the work group, which will include a number of different stakeholders, you know, students, faculty, bookstore managers, somebody from a textbook publishing company, people who are working in the area of open source textbooks, bringing people together to make recommendations to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, which will then make recommendations to us in the legislature for anything that might be require a budget or be involved legislation. And it will also then send recommendations out to the different institutions as well for things that they can do. We are looking for help in this process from all the universities, from all the community colleges, and through their organizations, and also the faculty unions. We know that they're very interested in this issue and are going to be supportive. Oregon Student Association, I know, is going to be facilitating this effort. We feel that we can do this really at no cost to the state. But, you know, with that as a preface, Karen, do you want to say something? Yes, Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I was glancing here because we've just seen this amendment and trying to listen to you. Did you talk about what the next amendment will be so we can have some heads up? And because this amendment is one of those you have to go through carefully and,
right.
and yeah. pick and choose. And so can you tell us what the possibility of that next amendment is?
I anticipate the next amendment, unless anything comes up that requires a further change, but that the next amendment would see, the way it is now, the first work on this would be done through the joint boards, which is a group that is a partnership between the State Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education for community colleges. Their work is going to be taken over by the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, July 1st. If the work is done through the joint boards, we've been told that there's going to be a fiscal cost of about $50,000. So this is going to ask that the formal work not begin until the HEC comes into place July 1st. There can be sort of preparatory work, but it won't require support from the State Board of Education, there's Cam looking me in the face, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And I think she can address that as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Co-Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith, and I represent the Oregon Community College Association, and once again want to express our strong support for House Bill 4058. We do support and have supported the notion of looking for ways to make textbooks more affordable, and as you've heard, affordability is a barrier for students, and we want to make sure that we're part of that discussion to come up with some solutions. And we look forward to working on this issue with you. We did have a minor issue with some language in the bill as it was introduced, but that has been addressed in the Dash 1 amendments, and we support the bill for that reason.
Thank you. Kim?
Well, good afternoon, committee members, Co-Chair Dembro. We have been in conversation in the last couple of days about the fiscal on this particular work group. And feel comforted with the fact that if it is the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission that really muscles the work forward as of July, that we certainly support the concept of doing this work and would anticipate play a role in that. It's just adding one more task force to our burgeoning list. So thank you for your work on that, on reducing the cost.
Any questions of Karen or Cam? Yes.
It might be a question of the co-chairs, but maybe not. I noticed that the Dash 1s eliminated line 4 on the back. The main focus of the bill and the main issue.
Glad you brought that up.
The main issue.
I'm sorry you brought that up.
Oh, thank yes. you, Representative.
Sorry.
We're just going to go there.
I mean.
Wondering about that.
That was the look at application of K through 12 school districts. I mean, clearly the main focus and the main need as a parent of a high school junior, I can tell you that I'm fearful of is the college textbooks. I'm just wondering if that was done by intent in order to just keep the focus there, or if there was some other reason.
Yeah.
I didn't intend to wade anything into something between the co-chair.
No.
Okay. It just occurred to me as well. So
yes.
I'd like
yes.
to hear the answer too.
Well, so it's again, it's the F word, and not focus, but fiscal.
Oh. Okay.
So. The reason that line four was in there is initially is that we think it's an important topic, that especially as more high schools are offering dual credit programs, that if we're coming up with alternative ways to lower the cost of textbooks for college students, then high school students taking dual credit courses are going to benefit from that. And in addition, I think some of the work that we're going to be doing in terms of looking at open source and online, et cetera, could be beneficial for K-12. Textbook costs are a huge driver of the cost of K-12 education as well. However, to make that a formal part of the work of this task force would cost a $5,000 fiscal charge by the Oregon Department of Education.
I'm with you.
So that has been removed as a formal part of the charge of this task force.
Emphasis on the word formal?
That's correct. Another F word.
Mr. Chair. However, if we are, in fact, trying to be as thrifty as possible, and at some point in time, I do believe that we do need to address the cost of textbooks or books in general in our K-12 world, would it not make sense to have this task force take on those topics concurrently with higher ed sourced material as well as K-12 world? In our school district, a textbook adoption, which we haven't done probably for the last 3 years because of budget constraints, is about $120,000, which is probably a couple of teachers. As you talk about, grade level of debt, whether you're talking about fourth grade math, fifth grade science, it's not inexpensive. And obviously those are expensive that a lot of districts have put on the shelf because they haven't been able to afford them because they've just been trying to keep the doors open and survive. But I guess as we talk about negotiating our way through the ways and means process, there could be a good case be made for, in the long run, there could be, rather than convening another task force in another legislative session, this might be a way to provide input that could be helpful for the entire public ed world, but those would just be my thoughts at this point in time, Mr. Chair. So you and I perhaps can talk about that.
We can talk about it, yeah. Great. I think we share the same sentiment, certainly. Okay, well, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Committee, any further comments on this topic? Yes, Rep. Springer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually been sitting here with the same question for about the last 20 minutes trying to answer it myself, and apparently I can't. So as we talk about this process, which obviously getting the cost of textbooks down is a good thing in everybody's book except the textbooks company. That said, if we have faculty and we have folks, and I do believe we do, trying to, in the back room, as the professor mentioned, trying to find lower cost ways to do this. And I know that you certainly have. We've talked about that. So individually, you've taken responsibility to attempt to lower the costs. And apparently in 07, before I came, there was a bill. I don't know what the bundling is, if it was about unbundling, but there was a bill brought. And so those suggestions, as they have surfaced, have come to us. We can't control what textbook companies are charging and how they're functioning. So the question that I've sat here and wrestled with the last 20 minutes is, what is it we hope to achieve through this task force process that a task force is required to achieve? Remembering the goal, I don't think anybody is going to argue with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the thinking is that by bringing together a statewide group of people to tackle this problem, there's going to be a lot of cross-fertilization of ideas that, ultimately, some of them can have, a statewide sort of implementation ability. If the colleges and the universities can maybe come together to do their purchasing in bulk, that could be a good thing. Will that require statutory changes? I don't know the answer to that. I would think not. But having a process to look at those kinds of issues with the sanction of the legislature and then under the auspices of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, that's really what that coordinating commission was meant to do, to coordinate those kinds of conversations and then to make recommendations to the individual institutions. So that's the hope, that's the goal. And, you know, I do believe that by that there are significant savings that can come as a result of the findings of this group.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
You and perhaps Representative Greenlick may have some insight on this. I have zero. Have the colleges, and maybe Cam can weigh in on this, have the colleges taken some initiative at any point in the past to come together and say, how can we do some statewide purchasing here? And have there been individual initiatives to move forward to make some of these things happen? I'm not trying to kill a task force by any means, and I want to get to the goal. I'm just thinking, why does a legislature have to create a task force to say, let's save money on textbooks when everybody wants to save money on textbooks? Let me be argumentative. As we're cutting budgets, I'm thinking,
You raise a very legitimate issue. And, you know, I think that, you know, the answer to your question of whether these kinds of things are happening is I don't believe that they are happening. You know, I do believe that the bookstore managers do get together and talk about how can we do things better, you know, best practices, more professional, et cetera. They're a very professional group of people. But in terms of...
it's not in their best interest to save money.
Sure.
Is that accurate?
You know, they are very responsive. They feel a sense of responsibility to the students, I think.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My comment. If one were a conspiracy theorist, which I'm not usually, one could get the feeling that academia in general, rather than Portland State or Oregon State or University of Oregon in particular, are complicit in this as a way of allowing faculty members to earn income, and some do earn significant income, on the side as a way of helping to keep faculty salaries low. And I'm not saying I buy that theory, but it's one I can't find any other explanation for. I mean, the first time I wanted to publish a book and the publisher said it would be have to sell for $95, I told him I'm not going to publish a book that has to sell for $95, and eventually figured out how to get it so it could sell for $40, which still seemed to me outrageous at the time. I don't think it's in anybody's best interest except the students to try and make this happen. And it's ridiculous that a legislature should have to do it. You're absolutely right. But I don't see any other way it's going to happen.
Thank you.
You know, just follow, you know, as we heard from the students, we're in a desperate situation, I believe. And we need to do what we can to try to kickstart the, you know, the conversation and the strategizing and, you know, looking at the best practices around the country to do what we can to fix this problem. And, you know, that's, you know, that is the goal of this bill, and I hope that we can pass it, and I hope that it will achieve that goal.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further comments? Okay. So, you know, I hope we'll have these final amendments on Tuesday. So with that, I'll close this public hearing on House Bill 4058. And Tuesday, it looks as if it's going to be a catch-up day on a couple of our bills.
Day two.
We need to deal with the other The one that we put off on yesterday, was that only yesterday, the STEM bill, 4056. We have received a definitive word that the subsequent referral will not be rescinded, and so we will need to vote on Tuesday, either to send it to Ways and Means or to not allow it to move forward. We will hopefully have amendments on this bill and the textbook bill, hopefully we'll have fiscals on all of them so that we can move bills forward on Tuesday. We'll also be having a public hearing on the staffing ratio reporting bill and the bill about prior learning assessments and Western Governors University. So it should be an exciting day. With that, everyone, I will call this meeting to an end. This committee is adjourned.